Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Ben Karp on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Rebels Rising, Cities in the American Revolution. I remember when I first went to the Soviet Union many, many years ago, something that struck me was the fact that there were very few bars in Moscow, and in fact very few bars in major or even minor Soviet cities in general. You would think that in a city such as Moscow that there would be lots of drinking establishments, because after all, people do like to drink, and Russians like to drink more than most. But there were very few of them, and I wondered why this was so. At the time, I thought it was because the Russian government or the Soviet government was trying to prevent Russians from destroying their lives with alcohol. Now I think rather differently about this. I think that the Soviet government knew that bars and pubs and taverns were the kinds of places where people met to gripe about the government and even plan revolutionary activity. They had some experience here because we know Lenin, when he lived in Switzerland, was a habitué of cafes and pubs where he met with his revolutionary friends to plan the Russian Revolution. Well, it was ever thus, as we can see in Ben's book. It deals with late 18th century America, particularly major cities, where people met in bars and taverns and pubs and churches and on wharfs and in squares and near-market stalls and in many, many different places of public accommodation. And one of the things that he points out is that this is really where the concept of civil society, which is a little bit amorphous, becomes real. That is, these are the places where the public exchanged information and moved forward with political activity. He calls them places of mobilization, which is a good a name as any. I really enjoyed talking to Ben today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm pretty well. Where are you exactly? Are you in the Boston area?
No, I am. It is the summer. I am in New York City, and it is a very rainy day here.
Very rainy day in New York City. I see. So you just split your time between Boston and New York then, or?
Yes, I suppose. I've been on sabbatical and chose to spend the time away from the archives, and so I'm in New York.
Well, you certainly spent a lot of time in the archives. I can tell our listeners that. You've visited every archive on the East Coast. I should tell our listeners, by the way, that we are talking to Benjamin Karp today, and we'll be discussing his terrific new book, Rebels Rising, Cities and the American Revolution. It is the only book I've ever read that comes with a playlist. We'll talk a little bit about that later. I was very interested in the playlist. But why don't we begin, Ben, by having you tell us a little bit about yourself, which is to say where you were born and where you grew up and anything else that you think would be of interest to our listeners.
Sure. I was technically born in Queens, but brought home to a house in Woodmere, New York, which is in the Five Towns on the South Shore of Long Island. Went to George W. Hewlett High School. I think I'm at least the third professional historian I know that graduated that high school. And then I went to Yale University as an undergraduate, and then to the University of Virginia for my PhD. Mm-hmm. And then I taught at the University of Edinburgh for a little while, and now I'm a professor at Tufts University.
Tufts University. I actually used to live in Somerville near Tufts, and I spent I don't know why this is relevant to anything, but I spent tons of time running around the Tufts track. I loved that track.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice track.
Yeah, I used to just run 5 miles there almost every day. I just loved that track, yeah. And I lived in Davis Square. That was before it was hip. of in Davisburg before it was hip. Yeah, I wasn't hip at all. Anyway, so how did you choose this particular topic in graduate school? Why cities and the American Revolution?
Well, I came at cities and the American Revolution when I was an undergraduate.
Oh, okay.
Actually. And it all came from a throwaway line in a famous William & Mary Quarterly article by Alfred F. Young on the shoemaker George Robert 12 Hughes. This was a shoemaker who had participated in the Boston Tea Party and was witness to the Boston Massacre and et cetera, et cetera. And at one point during the article, Professor Young has a throwaway line where he says, unlike his brother and unlike Ebenezer McIntosh, who was a crowd leader in Boston, George Robert 12 Hughes was not involved in a lot of civic organizations. He wasn't in a fire company, and so on. And I said, and at that point I read that line and I say, well, hold on, what did it mean to be a member of a fire company in the cities in the years leading up to the American Revolution? And so I was in a junior year seminar being taught by John Demos on the social history of the American Revolution, and I wrote a very bad paper in which I spouted off about fires and firefighting in a very disorganized way. And then I kind of spent the summer thinking about it, and then and kind of refined what I wanted to talk about. And then I wrote a senior thesis on firefighters and the American Revolution and their political participation, their political affiliation, what role it meant to be a part of a volunteer organization in these years where this idea of political volunteerism becomes very crucial for the revolutionary movement. Mm-hmm. And so later I revised that in graduate school, and it's now a kind of standalone article in the William & Mary Quarterly. But I knew I was going to have to think bigger than just firefighters if I was going to write a dissertation. So in conjunction with Peter Onuf, who was my principal advisor at the University of Virginia and working with a lot of other faculty as well, I came up with this idea of talking about political mobilization in a broader way as it happened in the five largest cities of British North America in the years leading up to the American Revolution.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're in very good company studying firefighters. If I recall correctly, and one of our listeners, I'm sure, will send me an email about this, Gibbon talks about firefighters in the Roman Empire. And one of the things he says, if I recall correctly, and it's been 25 years since I read this, he said that Christians refused to serve in the volunteer fire service and were a great drag on the Roman Empire. This is one of the many things that he said, knocking Christians in the 18th century. And then I have a friend that studies firefighters in the development of Russian civil society in the 19th century. Is there a broad strain of firefighter studies in civil society?
I'd be interested to hear about that Russian study. I've run into a few other students of firefighting in my time. It is a great topic because it does give you this entry point into thinking about a lot of other broader themes in American history, for instance. You can talk about the affirmative action, right? That's the case that that Justice Sotomayor have pointed to. You can talk about 9/11. You can talk about various aspects of racial acceptance, ethnic groupings, mm-hmm. gender equality. So for me, being someone who's principally interested in the 18th century, it was a way of talking about the revolution.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the thing that struck me while reading your book, I kept thinking about the word civil society, which I think is really a kind of a loose and baggy concept. I don't really know what it is. But when reading your book, it brought to mind the notion that all cities have to have things like firefighters. They also have to have things like taverns. We'll come to that in a second. And if you give people the opportunity to organize themselves, in this instance, organize a fire brigade, they might well get a taste for it feel a certain amount of confidence that they can organize themselves. And this is interesting in the comparative perspective because in the Russian case, and I studied Russia almost my whole career, the state almost never allowed anybody to organize anything. And so they lost that taste for it completely. And they really wouldn't do anything without some order from above. And this reticence to embark on self-organization and self-expression really cost them dearly when I guess I would say just modernity happened, because it was bound up with self-organization of various kinds, and the Russians proved to be extraordinarily unfit for it. They were fit for a lot of other things. I don't want to knock them. I mean, they built the largest empire in world history, but that they could not bring off. But anyway, let's go right to the content of the book. I love the way this book is organized, by the way, and I would suggest anybody who is thinking about writing a dissertation or writing a book, look at this book in terms of the way it's organized, because it's studies of particular things in particular cities. The things are different and the cities are different. So it has a beautiful symmetry. Each chapter is a different city and a different institution. Can I call it an institution? I don't know if I can.
Sure. I like the term sites of mobilization.
Okay,
or
sure.
Absolutely,
because we don't usually think about a bar or a pub or whatever as an institution, but I guess it is a site of mobilization. So I would say it's a wonderfully organized and completely telegraphic way to structure what you're talking about. And so I congratulate you on that. But why don't we just begin with the very first chapter, if I recall correctly, and that is about Beantown and the wharf there, the waterfront.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, you always have to start with Boston almost, because Boston, you know, is very often setting the pace for for revolutionary action. And in this chapter, I talk about I wanted to kind of lay out a little bit what the social and economic world of the city looked like. And so I looked at the Boston waterfront, because the waterfront fueled so much of what a trading city was all about. But it's not obviously just a place of economic importance. It also becomes a place of political importance. I look at two principal reasons. I guess I could boil it down to two principal reasons. For one thing, you have Parliament passing various trade restrictions, and that's going to be something that affects the waterfront directly. And you also have members of the Royal officers in the Royal Navy impressing sailors occasionally off of the harbor in Boston, meaning that they would involuntarily Shanghai a Boston resident and say, "You're in the Navy now," and which was not a situation you could escape easily. And also it didn't pay as well as being a merchant sailor, and so people were often reluctant to join the Royal Navy for that reason. And this isn't, you know, this is maybe a minor story in the larger revolutionary tale, but it is one of those encroaching oppressive things that makes people on the Boston waterfront a little bit insecure. Both these customs regulations, these trade restrictions, and impressment are two things that are making the waterfront a very fraught place to be in Boston, where people are very aware of their political rights in the years from the 1740s to the 1770s.
Mm-hmm. And so what was it about the wharf that radicalized people? And, I mean, the thesis of your book is that these places actually aid in the mobilization of political action. What was it about the wharf that that mobilized people?
Well, one of the things about the wharves and the docks, the place that you can broadly conceive of, and the counting houses, the places that you can broadly conceive of as the waterfront, is that it's a place where people from all walks of life in Boston are congregating. So you have the merchants who are at the kind of top of the food chain. You have shipbuilders and retailers who are, you know, for middling folk during that time. And you also have the various workers who are building ships, building barrels, carting goods back and forth, manning the ships, the coastal ships or transatlantic ships. And so the fact that you have all of those people congregating together, and you know, we're very, in an older time of historiography, we'd say, oh, well, you know, they're going to be at each other's throats because they have these very different class interests. But on the other hand, in order to make the waterfront run, in order for trade to flourish, some of that's going to be out of your control because of the nature of the transatlantic market. But, everyone is going to have to work together in order to make that waterfront run. And I don't want to romanticize that too much, but that is what it is about the waterfront and the mm-hmm. city more generally that makes it a really interesting place to study. And during the revolutionary years, what happens is that people come to conceive of that waterfront not just as a place that connects it to the rest of the world for trade, but it also becomes this kind of borderland between Boston itself and the rest of the world, and it's a borderland that can go either way. Either their loyalty is going to be to the British Empire, which controls most of their trade, or all of a sudden it's now going to be to Boston itself or to America, and that's the big decision that everyone on the waterfront suddenly has to make as they start to become annoyed with the policies of the British Parliament, etc.
Mm-hmm. How does something like that, a well-known historical occurrence like the Boston Tea Party, exemplify the ways in which wharfs aid in mobilization, or does it?
Well, I mean, that's one of many examples from the book of things that happen on the waterfront, and for good reason. What happens is that it starts out with a parliamentary restriction. There's already a tax on tea, and what the Tea Act of 1773 says is not only are we going to keep that tax on tea, but the East India Company is going to have special rights to bring its tea directly to Boston, which will enable it to sell tea more cheaply and undercut Boston merchants themselves. So this is annoying Bostonians for many, many reasons. And so the ships come in with this cargo, and all of a sudden the big controversy is: are the Boston crowds going to allow these ships to land, or will the Boston crowds be able to convince the owners of the ships, the captains of the ships, local officials to turn those ships around, send them back to London without unloading their cargo? And so it's at the waterfront that question becomes crystallized, that question becomes of crucial importance. You know, is that tea going to land there or not? The waterfront, you know, literally is the border, the entry point, into Boston. And so what ends up happening is, you know, in other ports, in New York and Philadelphia, they are able to convince the captains of those ships to turn around and go back to London, but in Boston the owners of the tea cargo are a little bit more stubborn, and they do not instruct those captains to turn around, and their laws enforce. You can't just turn around a ship. You really are supposed to enter your ship and pay duties on the cargo you've got before you can land. And so there's a 20-day deadline, those ships were going to have to unload their cargo, and the day before that deadline expires, the Bostonians say, okay, you know, we gave you every opportunity to turn the ship around, and instead they end up dumping the cargo.
Mm-hmm.
The Bostonians really would have preferred if the ships had just gone back to Great Britain, and so they later blame all these, you know, these stubborn tea agents and stubborn government officials who didn't allow that to happen. The point of looking at the space of the waterfront is that it's a place like that, this dynamic place where everyone was supposed to be working together, where you're trying to decide what your identity is, you know, where cargo and people are coming and going. It's no surprise at all that Griffin's Wharf becomes the site of an action like the Boston Tea Party.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask this because I've always kind of wanted to know, and I've been too lazy to ever really look it up. Why did some of them dress like American Indians?
Oh, I just wrote. I'm working on another book on the Boston Tea Party right now, and
mystifying.
I just wrote a whole chapter on that. Many, many, many reasons. Phil DeLoria wrote a book called Playing Indian, where he begins to explore this question, and he says it's a way of saying, okay, we are not quite British, right? They'd seen all these allegorical prints and paintings that always tended to depict America as an Indian woman or an Indian man. So if you looked at a Native American, you thought, okay, that's an American. But at the same time, they still have their white faces for the most part underneath, and so they knew they weren't quite Native American either. And so this becomes this kind of founding moment when Americans decide, okay, we are no longer European, but we're not quite Native Americans, indigenous people either, and we're something in between. And so they have a very positive view of that, of saying, oh, we're too free to be Europeans, and yet we're not so savage as to be Native Americans. That's their way of thinking. On the other hand, you could say, well, they're, you know, too crude to be Europeans and not quite free enough to be Native Americans. So there's multiple ways that you can look at that.
Sorry, I mean, the
main thing is, well, did they actually think that this would enable them to not be caught? And that's an interesting question. In many crowd actions, you'd have people look at a bunch of people who thought they were disguised and say, I know you and I know you. Because, I mean, Boston, for instance, is a town of only 16,000 people. Everybody pretty much knew who everyone was. Mm-hmm. And so were they actually trying to conceal their identities? I don't know. I think the disguise is meant to send a message saying, you might be able to tell who we are, but you'd better not tell anyone who we are. Because what this disguise means is we are trying to be, quote, persons unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And so you better not give us up. Otherwise, you know, because we don't really feel like being prosecuted or being liable to a civil suit from the East India Company.
I imagine it's complicated. I was going to say, I imagine the historiography of this particular and peculiar question is very interesting. That is to say that I imagine there have been a lot of different takes on why they dressed as Indians, and I imagine there are moments at which it might not even have been mentioned. I don't know if you go into that in your book, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, there are people in the 1820s and 1830s who try to claim, oh, I don't remember any of us being disguised, and, it's very clear that at least the core group of people definitely had disguises. Some of the disguises were not that thrilling. You know, some people just wrapped a blanket around themselves and kind of smudged their faces with whatever was handy, mm-hmm. and then they said, oh, okay, now I'm a Native American. And mm-hmm. they seemed to have talked in a kind of dialect that they claimed was a Native American dialect.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also kind of it's a playful sort of show. But for the most part, it hasn't been thought of as an interesting historical question why they disguised themselves until the last 10 years. So it's 10, 15 years. So it's actually a more recent question than you'd think, that now that historians are doing more cultural history, that all of a sudden it's a new way of getting at, the voice of the inarticulate, right?
Mm-hmm.
We could say, oh, well, this is a way of looking at festival disguises and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's connected to a larger literature on carnival, mm-hmm. on festivals, on mayfairs, etc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's very interesting. I'm sorry, I have to follow up with one more question.
Sure.
I'm sure that our listeners are probably getting upset with this digression, but was their idea of Indians generalized, or did they have particular Indians in mind?
They did. Their Mohawks seem to be the first tribe that they are called in the public press.
Uh-huh.
Someone else privately calls them Narragansetts. And then in a poem by Mercy Otis Warren, she refers to them as Tuscaroras. So those are the three identities that they get. And then it becomes interesting, you know, when a fourth tea ship washes up on Cape Cod, you have John Adams writing, oh, I hope the Mashpee Indians of Cape Cod will take care of this. And so they start to ascribe specific regional identities to, you know, different parts of America and saying, oh, if you're dressing up as an Indian and you're from Cape Cod, then you're a Mashpee Indian. And so they do come up with specific tribal appellations.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about that in the chapter. Why did they pick the Mohawks?
Mm-hmm.
And what was it about the history of relations between New England and the Iroquois that informed that particular idea? And the Narragansetts, I think, intrigued them because they were interested in the idea of a king of the Narragansetts and that there was an American king who was fighting against Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And that later becomes the British king who they're fighting against. But there was this idea that there was a Narragansett king who protected all Americans. And that becomes part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Enough for the time being about dress-up Native Americans.
Sure.
Let's move on. I had one more question just about this particular chapter and this business about Boston, and that is you mentioned crowds. I think I recall, and again, this has been 250,000 years ago in graduate school, I read a book by a guy named Georges Roudet called The Crowd in History. Am I wrong about that?
That's probably about right. He's Roudé and E.P. Thompson and other scholars of Europe have been very influential on early Americanists who are looking at crowd action.
Oh, really? Okay.
Leading up to the American Revolution.
Yeah, that was my only question. I just thought that I remember reading this literature. I remember also reading The Moral Economy of the English Crowd in graduate school. That's a work by Thompson and then that Roudé book. I just wanted to suggest to the listeners that there was a bit of a background here. So let's move on to taverns and bars and pubs and things like this, and then we move on to New York City, where you are right now. Why don't you go ahead and talk about that chapter and the way in which taverns served as a point of mobilization?
Well, that is a really fun chapter. Whenever I run into someone at a bar, you know, I can say, oh, I'm doing research when I'm in New York City. Taverns are a particularly exciting place for political mobilization to take place because on the one hand, you have these 18th century middle class and upper class men who are, you know, struggling in this kind of new early modern world and trying to organize their lives. And, you know, in a place like America, there isn't really an aristocracy to speak of, and so it's very difficult to know where everyone stands. And so you have this polite tavern culture that develops, and it has its own rituals, and some of them are very polite rituals, but some of them are rituals that revolve around getting drunk. And so taverns are also interesting because not only are they an attempt to make the world orderly, but they're also particularly disorderly places. They are places where people get drunk, where they have competitions to see who can hold their liquor the best. They are places where drunkenness often sometimes degenerates into violence. Basically they're particularly interesting places for politics to take place because we think that politics is supposed to be something of a rather orderly nature. But of course, as you're thinking about resistance to Parliament and the American Revolution, that's something that's disruptive of the social and political order. And so how can you make that kind of disruption happen in a tavern and yet control it? So this gets at one of the crucial questions of the book of Rebels Rising, which is yes, political mobilization is all very well and good, but how do you keep it under control, and how do you do so particularly in a tavern?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, if I recall correctly, the Sons of Liberty, whom our listeners may know about, they met in bars, didn't they? Am I wrong about that? Yeah, they did.
Yes, that's basically how they get to. That's where they're going to go to meet is at a tavern because that's a place that isn't. It's not a public building, right? It's not the townhouse or the state house, so it's not something that's an official government place. But it is a place where people can get to and people can get together. That isn't just somebody's, you know, an individual person's parlor. It's a place that's kind of semi-public, and it's part of, as you said before, civil society.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a place that isn't quite controlled by the government, but is a place where you can have random encounters and possibly recruit other people who might be sitting in the tavern with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, to go back to the Russians again, about whom I know quite a bit, the Russians were very worried about revolutionaries in bars, so they just didn't allow people to have bars. This was true of the Soviets as well. Did the British attempt to close down drinking establishments?
No, the British knew their own culture. I mean, I don't see how they could have sustained any kind of peace at all if they tried to close down bars. New York City in particular is a place where the city hall used to meet in a bar when the Dutch first came to America. That's where they ran the government of the city and the colony was from a bar, because very often it's just a larger building than an ordinary household, and until you get around to erecting a fort or a city hall or something like that, the bar is the place where people are going to collect. And when the British take over New York City from the Dutch and you have Walloons and African Americans and French and people from many different cultures gathering together in a diverse place like New York City, what else do they have in common but a desire to get drunk? And so I don't think the British ever would have, given the importance of taverns and coffee houses back in London, even though it very often becomes a thorn in the side of the ruling party during the 18th century. I don't think they ever, I don't know my British history as well, but I don't think they ever would have seriously entertained closing down taverns. I just think it would have been such an unpopular move because drinking was the thing to do in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. And the 20th. Well, it does point up an interesting cultural difference, and that is, again, speaking as a native Midwesterner, when people are planning rebellion and revolt here in the Midwest, ordinarily we meet in the basement of the Lutheran church and drink coffee. We don't meet in bars, but we do have a big bar problem here in the Midwest. I think all over the United States, actually, especially in college towns, the way people drink is, I don't know. I have some questions about it, but I do understand what you mean about bars being the kind of places where people will meet and plan revolution. Are there any famous bars that are still around in New York City where they did this kind of thing?
The closest you've got is Francis Tavern, which is a restoration. There's a museum on the upstairs because this was the place where George Washington said farewell to his troops. And then there is a working restaurant on the first floor. So you can go to the southern tip of Manhattan, and you can go to Francis Tavern, and that would be the only surviving tavern from this period that you could visit. And even then, it doesn't really look like it did in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when they met in these bars to plan things, did they drink? And
yes.
I ask that because it's often the case that drinking goes with a rather non-productive activity. And it's just my own personal opinion. But yeah.
Well, but I think because fresh water tended to be a little bit more dangerous to drink in the 18th century, they were drinking alcohol more frequently, and I think that they had a better tolerance than we do nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one thing that we ought to say. And, you know, it's not, there were people like William Smith who were uncomfortable with the amount of drinking that happened at these sort of meetings, and so they did try to limit themselves to a glass of wine or two. But yes, whenever you have the records of a group like the Boston Committee of Correspondence meeting at they tended to meet in the Selectmen's Chamber, but if you, a group like the Freemasons meeting at the Green Dragon Tavern or something like that, you generally see in the bylaws of the group, you know, the rules for settling the tavern bill, and very often you can see the bill that they paid. And so, yes, they were definitely drinking punch and sometimes eating as well. I mean, you could also get a meal in a tavern. It wasn't just about drinking.
Yeah, of course, the most famous revolution ever fomented, and this one unsuccessfully in history, is the beer hall putsch, and that one went all pear-shaped, thankfully. In any event, that was Hitler, by the way, for those of you who don't know. So let's, why don't we move on to a rather more peaceful, let's hope. Maybe not. The peaceful confines of Newport, and there you talk about religious establishments, of which there were a surprising number. Go ahead.
Yes, Newport is a very diverse place. I mean, if I had concentrated on Boston in my chapter of churches, I would have been telling a very different story, because the loyalists and friends of government in Boston constantly accused ministers in Massachusetts of fomenting revolution, and so the church, especially dissenting churches in New England, were as dangerous as taverns, as places where political mobilization took place. You could have a minister giving a fiery sermon, you know, that related to the conflict with Great Britain, and was mobilizing people in a way that was every bit as potent as the way that alcohol and the freedom of a tavern could mobilize people. But Newport is a little bit different. The Congregational churches, the ones presided over by Ezra Stiles and Samuel Hopkins, those were places where people who later became known as patriots tended to congregate. Those were places where political mobilization was tending to take place. But in Newport, because it's Rhode Island rather than Massachusetts and Connecticut, the Congregationalists are a distinct minority within that community, and most of that community are Quakers and Baptists, and then you also have Anglicans who are very significant presence, and Jews and Moravians and people like that. So Newport, because it's such a diverse place, a religiously diverse place, mobilization in churches, and as it happens, mobilization in the rest of the city, becomes a little bit more difficult, because Anglicans tend to be supporters of the British Crown. Quakers were pacifist and felt that they ought to be obedient to the government in charge. And Baptists didn't, like the Quakers and Anglicans, just didn't trust the Congregationalists who were running around and fomenting this revolution. And so what you get is what I call a civic impasse. Everything kind of grinds to a halt because you can't, because religious acrimony is sufficiently bitter that it's very difficult to organize people together, even though Newport had been, for the most part, a very tolerant place where, for the purposes of business, everybody, people from different religious backgrounds got along with one another very well. But when it came to this very contentious question of the revolution, it's harder to organize people together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. I don't trust Congregationalists to this day, to be honest with you. But I have two questions. One is separation of church and state, something we all know about. There was no notion of this then at the time. I mean, it does get enshrined in the Constitution later.
Well, there is. I mean, there is a state church. There's the Church of England, but mm-hmm. in New England, in Massachusetts or in Connecticut, it's the Congregational Church that's the established church instead, mm-hmm. and Rhode Island does not have any established church at all. And so Rhode Island, Pennsylvania is the same way. Most of the Quakers had basically founded the colony, but there was no kind of established church that everyone was forced to pay taxes to. But that is true into the 19th century in Massachusetts and Connecticut, that you kind of have to pay local taxes to the Congregational Church. And the Baptists get in Massachusetts are getting upset about this before the revolution even starts.
Yeah.
So, and then the Church of England is established in the southern colonies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called a kind of low church Anglicanism that someone like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson are subscribing to. And so they, you know, aren't as hierarchical as what's called high church Anglicanism, which is what tends to prevail in these battered outposts of the Church of England in New England.
So these multiple churches in Newport, did they help or hurt the revolutionary cause? It seems like they would hurt it because they would divide people rather than unite them against British tyranny. Am I wrong about that?
Well, without the organizational capability of a church, it is hard to, in this society where people are very religious, it is hard to get a political movement going, ironically. And so the congregational churches do become useful for political mobilization. The problem is that the Congregationalists aren't the majority. And so you do have people of every religious background. You have Quakers and Baptists and Jews who support the revolution, but you do have a patriot movement that is somewhat successful in Newport, but it's harder to get people together along religious lines in particular. And I should say that New York is just, and Philadelphia are just as pluralist as Newport, and they have very successful revolutionary movements. One of the other problems that happens in Newport is that after 1774, there's a naval presence in the harbor, and that kind of prevents mobilization of any kind, whether within a religious setting or within a secular setting.
Yeah.
So, but in New York and Philadelphia, they face some of these same challenges of you really have to work at overcoming religious differences sometimes in order to put this secular movement together. And so at some times in Newport and New York and Philadelphia, they're successful at overcoming these religious differences, especially organizing against the Stamp Act, for instance, and sometimes they're less successful.
And let me ask this really quickly. You may not know. How involved – by some metric, were clergymen in the rebellion?
Well, clergymen are not technically supposed to hold political office. Mm-hmm. That was considered something of a taboo in New England and then beyond. But they are providing aid and comfort to not all of them. You know, some of them are definitely become outspoken loyalists. Particularly some of the New York Anglicans and so on. So you have some very outspoken loyalist members of the clergy, but you also particularly Congregationalists in Massachusetts and Connecticut and Rhode Island who are providing aid and comfort to this rebellion by giving inspiring sermons. It's possible that in small towns where the clergyman was the most literate person present, that they were helping to draft patriotic resolve in some of these small towns. Clergymen often had very good connections among the wealthy and influential people in town, and so they could write letters of introduction when patriots were traveling from one place to another. And so they're providing help behind the scenes, and sometimes very overtly, in terms of the sermons that they give and the Thanksgiving days that they host, and when they host women spinning homespun cloth in the church or at their homes. And so, yeah, they're helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reason I ask is I've always wondered about this question, because given my reading of, let's say, the Apostle Paul, it's very difficult to square sort of conventional Christianity with the notion that you should overthrow even tyrants. So if they did speak in a kind of what we would think of as a religious language about the rebellion, if they did use religious texts, which were one of their touchstones, as a basis for the rationale for their rebellion, I always kind of wondered, and again, maybe everybody knows the answer to this question, I always wondered kind of how they worked their way around that. That is, even overthrowing a tyrannical king is not really advised by mainline Christianity, I think.
Well, when it's if you think that you've got the right answer for practicing Christianity, and you think that a government is threatening civil and religious liberty, then you can kind of justify it, because then you become a kind of oppressed in the same way that the original Christians were oppressed. But I know of another scholar who's working on chaplains for the American side during the revolution, and so she would probably be able to get at that question a little bit better than me. But yeah, they find biblical verse to justify what they're doing, that's for sure.
Yeah, but then
Thomas Paine uses a little bit of biblical language, actually, in Common Sense. I mean, that was how you knew how to connect to ordinary Americans, because you knew that most of them had read their Bible, mm-hmm. and so biblical verses are invoked all the time. Mm-hmm. During the revolution.
Yeah, I always find it very interesting when Christians look for a textual basis for whatever politically radical activity, particularly, they tend to become Jews rather suddenly and start talking about the Hebrews in Egypt. That those seem to be like the place where you
right.
get the money shot. Yeah.
In the Old Testament, the Jews got away with being a lot more violent, and God himself was a lot more wrathful. But,
yeah, exactly. But
those are tried to change the tone in the New Testament.
Right, exactly. But that's where you go for, sort of people being God's people being oppressed, and then sort of rebelling or being freed by the Lord. So it's kind of interesting. I was, these things are, they're tricky. They really are, because some of the way in which the Bible has, in both its books, the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible, has shaped Western political culture is just a fascinating topic. It's a little bit like the way I think the Supreme Court reads the Constitution every year. And you can see, if you study the Supreme Court at all, you can see that the same language has been interpreted in diametrically different ways over the past 200 years. And the same is true of a lot of biblical texts, that they were read one way a long time ago and they're read entirely differently today. And I personally find that process fascinating. In Christianity, we call it, or they call it, the doctrine of continuing revelation. I always really like that very much, continuing revelation.
If
it
weren't for a successive reinterpretation of texts over succeeding generations, I think historians would be out of business.
Yeah, so, damn straight. I think you're absolutely right about that. Yeah.
You ought to appreciate that process.
No, it's you're really quite – who's really good on this is Quentin Skinner. I don't know if you ever read his work on early modern political philosophy.
Yeah.
He wrote some books, I think, called The Fundamental of the Western Political Philosophy, something like that. I can't remember, but two-volume book. And he talks a lot about how these texts were interpreted and reinterpreted, and I just found it all very fascinating, and he was a formidable scholar. He may be still alive. I said was. I don't know. So let's move on then to Charleston, which is a very nice city, and talk about revolutionary mobilization in houses and domestic spaces.
Right. Well, I thought it would be too easy to only talk about places where people naturally congregate, down by the wharfs for commerce, in church every Sunday, and sometimes more often, and sometimes on Saturday, for worship, or in taverns for drinking, because the basic unit where people tend to spend a lot of their time is, after all, the household, a place that we don't necessarily think of as public, but a place where public political mobilization can indeed take place. And the reason why I was interested in Charleston is that there, the plantation in the South, the plantation household has so much resonance for us, and I wanted to see how, if you transplanted that that household setting to an urban house lot, how did the dynamics of revolution and social relations play out? What did it mean about relationships between men and women in the household? What did it mean in terms of relationships between master and slave in the household? And then, speaking a little bit more metaphorically, how did Americans think about their relationship to the House of Hanover and then the Republican household that they were then creating? Did this were they going to be moving to a new house next door? Henry Lawrence is using that metaphor explicitly. He's a Charleston planter, someone who made a lot of money trading slaves and owned a lot of land where his slaves grew rice, and now he lives in Charleston. And he becomes part of the Patriot movement, although somewhat reluctantly at first. And he, when talking about the Declaration of Independence, he describes it as, well, some of the furniture is liable to get damaged as we move to a new house next door. And what he meant was that he was very worried about whether social relationships could stay the same during this moment of upheaval, not just between masters and slaves and between men and women, but also among different types of white men, the backcountry as opposed to the low country, or artisans as opposed to wealthy planters. How are the mobilizers of the revolution going to manage those social relationships going forward? Because the gentry in South Carolina basically controlled everything. They control most of the wealth. They control the political power almost exclusively. They control social and social relationships, cultural style, etc. They are the masters of the house in so many ways. And it's interesting to see how they navigate everything as the revolution unfolds, how they make accommodations towards certain groups and yet tighten controls over other groups. And so that was what I was looking at in that Charleston chapter. And mm-hmm. So you can see reflections of this in the North too. In the North, the wealthiest members of society don't have quite as exclusive control over their workforce, for instance, but they still would rather stay on top. And so it's interesting to see wealthy gentlemen in both the North and South managing these social relationships during a time of political upheaval.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, like the certain passages in the New Testament, particularly Paul's letters, the existence of patriarchy presented kind of a sticky wicket to the revolutionaries themselves, because on the one hand, if you say, yes, you are perfectly justified in overthrowing a tyrant, what does that say about a tyrannical patriarch in a household?
Right. And Samuel Johnson said, why is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the keepers of slaves?
Yeah.
So, there were plenty of people who were willing to point out this contradiction at the time.
Yeah, that would have been worked out quite a while ago by, if I recall correctly, James Filmer in a book called Patriarchia, which was what Locke was responding to in the two treaties on government. I really can hardly believe that I remember that, but I think I do. So this has been the discussion for a long time because, for political philosophers, this symmetry is just too beautiful to pass up. That is, God is in his heaven as the king is on his throne, as the master of the house is at the hearth. It's just too nice, and they go for it all the time. But if you were going to suggest that you can overthrow tyrants, then That is going to have some scary implications. Did they confront these directly? I mean,
if I can use a non-South Carolina example, John Adams is worried about this sort of thing too. A lot of people looked around and they said, students are being obnoxious to their teachers, children are being obnoxious to their parents, women are being obnoxious to men, servants and slaves are being obnoxious to their masters. There were plenty of elite members of society in the 18th century who were really unhappy about some of the social forces that were being unleashed by the revolution, and eventually you know, the elite is able to bring things back under control, but society does not look precisely the same after the revolution. Slavery, of course, is still in place, and you know, women are still subject to coverture and all sorts of restrictions on their rights. But among white men, the chessboard looks a lot different after the revolution. And so, you know, there is a sense that you can't necessarily put the cat back in the bag once the revolution is all over.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because I think if you flash forward to 1830 and Tocqueville coming to America, I mean, he basically says that Americans are obnoxious. I mean, insofar as he says, that's what he – I mean, if you read between the lines, he says they treat each other equally. But what he says is they have no respect for each other. They are obnoxious by his standards. So it wasn't as if those people were really wrong. Authority did break down, at least of the kind that the English were used to.
Sure. And you know, and the elites really struggle to reassert their authority. And that's, you know, that's what subsequent decades are going to be all about in American history.
And now everybody is obnoxious. Deference is gone, except to professional athletes, I think. But no, that's just my own personal feeling about that. But and my students are not rude to me. They're actually very nice. I have to say that. They're very, very nice to me.
Academics like to think that that's because now everything is respected on the basis of meritocracy.
But, yeah, no, I think it's just because I give grades.
Ourselves.
Yeah, no, I'm more of a Chicago school guy there. I think it's because they know I have a little bit of power over them. So once that's over, that they're
it's
not
going to be a bad grade.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I think they know. They know where they know where the power is, so they're nice to me. I don't know if that's true. I'll probably hear from them about that. So let's move on then.
Are the tuition payers, right? They're
yeah, exactly. Well, they
different loci of power.
That's exactly right. I like to tell people that I serve the people of Iowa. I really do, just like any public employee. Let's move on to Philadelphia then, which is again one of my favorite cities. Although they took the Rocky statue down, which was a huge mistake. So there you talk about. What we usually think of actually as the kind of locus classicus of revolutionary activity, and that is the – I'm sure I'm going to get the words wrong – but the State House and these sort of public squares and spaces. Go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, the Pennsylvania State House is now what we know of as Independence Hall. And so I was looking at that. That's obviously a classic symbol of the revolution. It's on the back of the $100 bill. But I was also looking at Independence Square, which is now which was then called the State House Yard, which is not an area that we normally think about. That's actually where a lot of the action was happening, not the signing of the Declaration of Independence, but the crowds that were gathering in the thousands and helping to push some very reluctant delegates towards feeling more permissive towards independence. And so, yes, that's the space that I'm looking at in Philadelphia, is playing with this idea of politics out of doors. That in Pennsylvania, eventually the people got really annoyed with the Quaker-dominated provincial government, because they had all this power and they weren't necessarily advocating for the things that many Westerners or many Presbyterians or many Sons of Liberty wanted to see happen. And so eventually there's more and more of this out-of-door agitation until basically the provincial assembly is dispensed with entirely. And that's the moment when independence becomes possible. Of course, you know, this is a society that had been founded by Quakers, and they try to do all of this very politely. And there isn't actually a lot of overt violence in Philadelphia in a way that you see in Boston and New York. Part of that is also because there's not a British troop presence in Philadelphia during these years. But yeah, that's the dynamic I'm looking at for Philadelphia, is the agitation that takes place just outside of this famous building, the State House. Later Independence Hall. It's the agitation taking place just outside it that really fascinated me, because there are just a series of these meetings after the passage of the Stamp Act, in response to the Tea Act, when the Continental Congress is meeting, where just hundreds of people are gathering in this square and making their voice heard, and politics out of doors becomes this crucially important force in local, provincial, and imperial politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this chapter resonated with me significantly, because I was fortunate enough to be in the Soviet Union when it became Russia and the Commonwealth of Independent States in 1991 and 1992, and I got to see how important these public places were for the movements, because there were many of them in 1991 and 1992, but they're kind of main squares, not really squares, because the Soviets built their cities in order to avoid this kind of thing, but they really couldn't prevent it. There were places where people knew to congregate all over the city. Dzerzhinsky Square was one of them, and Red Square was another, but there were also a series of large train stations in central Moscow, and people knew to congregate there, and there would just be spontaneous protests all over the place. And the funny part about it was is that you couldn't really tell the protests from what they called the Talkuchka, which is basically a spontaneous market where people would just show up and sell stuff. So as a foreigner, I couldn't really tell. I was like, well, is that a protest? Are they protesting something, or are they over there selling stuff? I couldn't really tell. But they all took place in these locales, which then became identified as that's where you go to register your protest. The Soviets, by the way, never allowed any of this stuff. It was absolutely off limits. But after 91, it really blew up. So as I say, this really resonated with me. Let me go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because in Philadelphia, the initial place that I talk about is the old courthouse, which no longer exists. It was destroyed in the 19th century, but the courthouse where the city government met was built right on top of the market stalls. And that used to be the public space where everyone congregated. And you did have some very violent election fights in the 1740s and it gets hairy during elections in the 1760s. That's where elections for the provincial assembly for the Philadelphia delegates are held. And so it is a very raucous place. And the State House is built, like just as you were saying about the Russians and the Soviets, they did build the State House with the idea that those kind of gatherings wouldn't take place there, because they built it on what was at the time the outskirts of the city. The State House yard has an 8-foot wall encircling it. It's a space that you can very much, that in an ideal world for them, they would have been able to watch and control and manage. But that doesn't happen, right? The meetings happen in Independence Square anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I found that to be an interesting twist on what unfolded during those years.
Well, and still goes on. I mean, what happened, the Tiananmen Square riots, or whatever you want to call them, were in Tiananmen Square. So I think your thesis is an extraordinarily good one. Let me ask you to talk just a little bit about the final chapter, the epilogue, really. And I found it completely fascinating and compelling. And the thesis of it, if I recall correctly, was that the British did what they could do, and that's what armies can always do, and that is take cities. So they took these coastal cities, and then because the cities became identified with the British occupation and with loyalism, they kind of fell out of favor in the American consciousness. Can you talk a little bit about that? Do I have that right?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, yeah, what's fascinating is the main thesis of one of the main arguments of my book is that the cities are crucially important for making the revolution possible. There are these dynamic places where political mobilization is taking place. Almost all the incidents that we read about from 1765 to 1774, it's hard to imagine how the revolution would have happened without the cities and their communicative capabilities and just their importance as dynamic places. But as soon as the military enters into this story in a serious way, the equation completely shifts. At that point, because of the power of the British Navy and the British desire to occupy these cities, at that point, the cities are vulnerable. For the same reason that you build a city in the first place, it's because it's on a deep harbor and you're going to be able to trade there and you're going to be able to welcome ships from all over the world. Well, unfortunately, that means it's also very easy for a naval ship to get in there. And the British Navy was so much more powerful than anything the Americans could put forth that all these cities immediately become extremely vulnerable. And from the very beginning, the Americans say, well, that's okay. You know, despite these cities having been important, and they weren't necessarily willing to acknowledge that importance, but despite the fact that we, you know, love these cities and whatever, we will happily abandon them. We'll be able to live off the fat of the land in the countryside. We'll be able to get goods to one another and march troops in the interior of the continent, and you can take any of these cities that you want, and all we have to do is make them miserable places for you to be and basically trap you there, and you'll never have control over any of the area of North America except for these little cities. And now, I mean, they're not totally in agreement about that. They do give up these cities very reluctantly, and the city fathers of each of these cities are often you know, kicking and screaming about this, and they're, you know, they become angry with the army that the army is willing to abandon those cities. But once those cities are abandoned, they really become a millstone around the necks of the British Army. And the cities are the last places that the British leave. But they're only helpful in some respect. They're good places to quarter troops. They're good places to quarter your army in winter. They're good places to dock your ships. But they turn out to not be that effective for launching their troops further into the interior. They make a stab at that in South Carolina, and then eventually it's all going to fall apart on them because they overextend themselves. Mm-hmm. But just holding a city does not mean that you hold an entire colony in America. And so, yeah, what happens then is that the Americans then will turn against the cities in a sense and diminish their importance in future years, and they'll say, oh, you know, look at that. You know, the cities were the places where they were able to gather all these loyalist civilians, where the British were able to gather all these loyalist civilians to their side. These are places where we sort of remember a lot of riots and mutinies happening anyway. We were sort of unhappy with some of the political unrest that was going on. Maybe these large coastal cities won't be at the center of American politics anymore. And over the next few decades, what you'll see is state capitals moving further inland to smaller towns like Albany or Richmond, and you'll see, you'll see cities play not as big a political role. They'll still be of tremendous economic importance, but their political importance, it won't be quite the same as what it had been during the 1760s and 1770s.
Yeah, I find all that completely fascinating. Again, especially in the kind of comparative perspective, because on the one hand, what you say reminds me of the much later, I believe it's Mao, who is famous for saying something like, the rebellion in the countryside is like a fish in water. Did he say something like that? I can't really remember. It was something like that.
The Chinese history is not necessarily
not mine either, as you can tell. But one of our listeners can contact me about the proper thing that he said. And then the second thing is that if you look at revolutionary iconography, and again, I don't know a lot about these things, but you know, the things that flash into my mind when I think about the Revolutionary War as opposed to the pre-revolutionary period are Washington crossing the Delaware. There he's in the middle of nowhere, right? Minutemen, and if you've ever been, you of course have been to Lexington, Concord. That's like, you know, out on a field, and there's a guy with a rifle, or not a rifle, but a musket. And there's the signing of the Declaration of Independence. That's kind of a famous picture. But then if you take it and you compare it to revolutionary iconography in the Russian Revolution, it's all urban. In the Russian, it's all urban. It all takes place in St. Petersburg, storming the Winter Palace, and the rest of it. It's Lenin in Red Square, later in Moscow. It's all urban. It's totally urban. Whereas here we have kind of this, the cult of Cincinnatus kind of thing. I don't know. Someone's probably written a book about that in American history, but somebody should if they haven't, because we still.
One of the biographies of Washington is called Cincinnatus.
Yeah. Yeah, right. We still have that on the brain, and I think that's a good thing, by the way. But anyway, I found that extraordinarily interesting. And Americans still think of cities as kind of – they're still a little bit suspicious about cities as opposed to like the way French people think of – French people think cities are great and Paris is wonderful, but Americans still think
of
cities.
Yeah, and part of that is it's hard to talk about – if you're going to tell a rah-rah story of American history, it's very hard to talk about New York City, which is occupied by the British in 1776 and remains a part of the British until 1783. It's actually sort of intriguing to think like what would have happened if they turned Manhattan into something like Hong Kong and remained a British outpost. in the midst of America. I don't think that necessarily would have been realistic. But yeah, all of these cities become occupied by the British Army at one point or another.
Yeah.
And so these are, you know, places with not quite good reputations, if you want to see it that way.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The Hong Kong analogy is perfect, though. They really might have done something like that, but they didn't. So with all due respect to New Yorkers, you did a fine job during the revolution and so on and so forth. Well, Ben, we have taken up a huge amount of your time, and we really appreciate it, although I know that it's raining there and you can't go play in the park. Still, it's been very nice of you to share all of this with us. Our traditional final question on New Books in History is, of course, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, right now I am about three-quarters of the way through a manuscript on the Boston Tea Party, which I'm very excited about because we haven't had a full-length scholarly work on the Tea Party itself since the 1960s, and it's time for an update, and I have a lot of new things to say about that. And then in a subsequent project that I'm going to start at some point after I'm done with this manuscript is something that I wanted to spin out of that last chapter, the epilogue of Rebels Rising, so something we were just talking about. I'm going to be working on the phenomenon of destruction of towns, cities, and Native American settlements during the Revolutionary War. So those are my next two projects. The Tea Party book, I don't know what the production schedule is going to look like, but I'm almost done doing my part.
That's great.
So
that's great.
That'll be really exciting.
I was going to say, do you ever sleep? Do you sleep or anything like that?
I do sleep. Sabbatical has been helpful for at least being able to get some sleep.
Maybe they're putting something in the coffee up there in Somerville these days that they didn't have when I was there. I don't recall ever being that productive when I was there. So anyway, congratulations on those. And as I always tell the authors who have been so gracious as to be on the show, when you're done, definitely call me and we will we'll have another chat about both of those books. At least I hope that we will. Okay?
Well, thanks. Yeah, we'll talk Indian disguises again.
Okay. All right. Well, we've been talking to Ben Karp about his terrific new book, Rebels Rising, Cities in the American Revolution. Ben, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for a stimulating conversation.
All right. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Ben Karp about his new book, Rebels Rising, Cities in the American Revolution. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.